This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The release of a young man who had been sentenced to life without parole has been in the news a lot recently. Devontae Sanford was convicted and sentenced at age 14 for four murders. The courts recently found he was wrongfully convicted. In 2012, the Supreme Court banned the use of mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles, but that doesn't mean it's completely banned. Joining us via Skype to talk about that is Lisa Armstrong. She wrote an article for The Intercept entitled Hard Time. Under what circumstances is sentencing a juvenile to life without parole still possible?
Basically, judges are supposed to look at mitigating factors. So the age of the child, the crime that was committed, that child's background and other things. And then judges, based on that, are allowed to sentence someone to life without parole. If for whatever reason they determine that those factors mean that the person needs to be in for life, then they will sentence them to life. So it's up to a judge.
What do you mean by child's background?
The environment in which a child grows up, whether that person has two parents in the home, whether that person lives in a neighborhood where there's a lot of gun violence or there's violence in the home itself, basically how the person has been raised.
You wrote, in some states, judges are still giving juvenile life without parole sentences on a fairly frequent basis, and that Michigan has the highest per capita rate of these sentences. What's happening in Michigan that more juveniles are still being sentenced to life without parole?
Well, it seems to be a couple of things, and this came mainly from speaking with judges themselves. It seems that the laws in Michigan, where someone who is 17 is automatically tried as an adult, and then also the fact that people who are accessories to a crime can also be charged in the same way that someone who actually pulled the trigger can be, that's a factor. But it's also that judges are used to giving certain sentences. So they're used to giving life without parole for certain crimes, and they kind of have just continued doing that. So it's a pattern of behavior. And then I also heard from some people that in high-profile cases, such as the one that I featured in my story, judges are trying to appease the public. So the public wants these quote-unquote dangerous people to be locked up for life. So that's what's being done.
Right. The person you profiled as an example was a Detroit man named Robert Taylor. How old was he when he was sentenced to life in prison?
He was 16 when the crime was committed. I believe when he was actually sentenced, he was 17 or almost 18 years old.
What justification did the prosecution use to pursue that sentence?
The prosecution argued that he had been present. This was a case of murder. He and Ihab Masamani, who was his co-defendant, had carjacked someone and this young man, Matthew Landry, and he was killed. And the prosecution argued that Robert Taylor had been there and that even though he hadn't pulled the trigger, that, you know, he didn't do anything to stop it. So he was essentially culpable in the crime because he was there when it was committed.
How did the defense respond to that argument? How do they argue for a lesser sentence?
The defense for Robert, his lawyer said that he was not there when the crime was committed. And this is something that Robert himself told me and that Ihab confirmed. But they said that, yes, he had gotten in the car, but that he did not know what was going to happen. He wasn't in on this plan to commit the murder and that he wasn't there. So he therefore shouldn't have been sentenced to life.
So what are the people you've talked to, the judges, the lawyers, and so forth, do they think that this sentence, life without parole for a 16-year-old who may or may not have been at the scene of the crime at the time, do they feel that it's justified? Or how do they justify it?
Obviously, I mean, there are advocates who feel that it's not fair, that no child should really be sentenced to life without parole because, you know, they're not really able to make decisions as adults. And then there are prosecutors who feel, I mean, the prosecutor in this case did not speak with me, but I think the feeling is that these people are dangerous and that they should be off the streets. I did speak with people whose loved ones have been victims of crimes perpetrated by juveniles who feel that, you know, they should be locked up, that each time if there is a parole hearing or if someone's going to be resentenced, that these loved ones have to relive the crime and it's not really fair to them. If you commit the crime, then you should do the time, essentially, is what they're saying.
And by that, they mean for life, not everything.
For life, yes. I mean, it's this notion that you killed someone, you took someone's life, so therefore your life should be gone as well.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court decided the 2012 ruling banning life for juveniles was retroactive. But there are still many, in fact, thousands of juveniles serving those sentences across the nation. What's the reason for that?
Like, why are they still in? I mean, I think in each state, obviously, there's going to be a process to determine how those cases are going to be handled. So I think in some cases it would be years. If these people are going to be released, it would be years before they actually get out. I mean, aside from the reporting that I did on this story, I've also been talking with people, again, a lot of them in Michigan who've been in for decades. And it's not like anyone has contacted them and said, well, let's take a look at your case. They're aware of the ruling, but, you know, I think the process is going to be fairly slow before these people, if they are released at all, actually get out of prison.
So what do you want the readers of your article to take away? I mean, what's the main point you think they should understand?
That the Supreme Court ruled and said that these factors, like if in all of the cases that I've looked at, people have pretty much the same kind of life story where single parents, they grew up in pretty violent environments, they didn't have the best educations, there was often drug use or violence in the home. And so these are children who have not had the best opportunities. And so I think, you know, what advocates are saying is that that should be taken into consideration and that those people should be rehabilitated and then at some point released so that they can be productive members of society. But the judges that I profiled in the story have taken those very things, so those challenges that people have faced, and said, well, you face these challenges and therefore you should be locked up for life. And so that's the question that I want people to ask themselves. Is this fair? Is it right? Does it make sense? Is it the best use of taxpayer money? You know, because obviously money could be spent educating people versus keeping them in prison.
That's Lisa Armstrong. She wrote the article Hard Time for The Intercept. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.